This is a rebroadcast of a program on the year anniversary of the death of Marla Ruzicka, who died on April 16th, 2005. Some call her a saint, but her family laughs to hear that. There is no denying that she embodied love, compassion, and an indomitable will to make the world a better place. Marla Ruzicka, presente. Today is the first Sunday after the first full moon of spring. It's Easter Sunday. A year ago on this day, a young Lakeport woman, Marla Ruzicka, was on her way to visit an injured child just outside Baghdad as part of her ongoing humanitarian assistance work in Iraq, when her car took the brunt of a roadside explosion. She had collected survey information in Afghanistan and Iraq of actual civilian casualties, created an organization, Civic, the Campaign for Innocent Victims in Conflict, and lobbied Congress to fund compensation to individuals and families harmed in the invasion and occupation. Because of her work, only a week before her death, the U.S. military was forced to acknowledge that they did in fact keep track of civilian casualties, which up until then they had consistently denied doing. She was trying to get them to release these figures when she and her translator, Faiz Ali Salim, were killed. She was 28 years old. Speaking of the casualty figures she collected, Marla said, "To me, each number is a story of someone whose hopes, dreams, and potential will never be realized, and who left behind a family." Before the explosion took her life, she had lived to see Congress allocate funds for reparations, which now bears her name, the Marla Ruzicka Iraqi War Victims Fund. Administered by USAID and monitored by Civic, it has distributed over $20 million to Iraqis who have been the innocent victims of that conflict, mostly coming for projects to generate income for the families affected. How did this young woman become such an effective human rights advocate and organizer? To find out, we contacted her mother, Nancy, who graciously invited us to the Ruzicka's home in Lakeport. Over a delicious lunch, she, Marla's father, Cliff, and her twin brother, Mark, shared their memories of Marla and her evolution from rural, small-town girl to world-traveling social activist who commanded the attention of senators and even the Secretary of Defense to, as she put it, make the world a better place. We offer now an audio montage of what the Ruzickas told us about 6 weeks before this first anniversary of Marla's death. Interwoven is the voice of Marla herself at age 20, recorded by Andy Weiss and Robert Lozano of KPFZ in Lakeport when she was home on vacation from Long Island University in August of 1996. We begin with Marla.
Well, I was born and raised in Lake County. Actually, I have a twin brother, so I was born in Ukiah. They couldn't deliver twins at the time that I was born. And I grew up my whole life in Lake County, and my parents live here. And I was just taking advantage of a small community. I was active in everything from school sports to student council and just any community events. So that's my connection with Lake County. And I graduated from Clear Lake High School in 1995. I did a report in high school on human rights abuses in Guatemala. and I just couldn't believe what I read. I couldn't believe how humanly possible the people's stories were and how much suffrage and what the United States involvement was in that region. So I kept saving up and talking to my parents, come on, it's safe. And I went with a group based out of San Francisco that I've interned with for about 4 years now on a delegation looking at sustainable development and human rights issues at, like, during this time. This was 94, so during this time of peace and stability. And then I later met up with a caravan called Pastors for Peace and traveled to an area of returned refugees that were just making their way back from Mexico. Part of the peace process in 94 was allowing people to come back and to resettle and start new communities and so forth. So for me, that was an amazing, amazing experience to see people's strength. And I remember a girl my age, she helped me get water to brush my teeth and wash my face. And she had fled to Mexico when she was about 8. And I looked at my life kind of, well, I was playing soccer or running in tag games when she was watching family members mutilated. And just how they're working so hard to build a new community. Getting at the root cause of the poverty, I think Gandhi said it, poverty is the worst form of violence. And so part of that is the land distribution, giving land to peasants who have no land, because if there's going to be peace, they have to work on concrete steps to, you know, help eliminate the poverty and so forth. Some people have called Guatemala economic apartheid, with the indigenous people that, you know, that are 67% of the population having hardly any land.
I'm very curious, Mark. You and Marla were twins. Mm. Who was born first?
Me, 6 minutes.
And they spent their summers in the water in Clear Lake. If there's ever a playground that anybody used, it was Mark and Marta in Clear Lake.
You know? Yeah, we were there all the time in the water, constantly. I don't know, I guess we started taking swimming lessons, I guess, at like 6 months old.
Yeah.
Mount Kanakdai, Mom, she got a permission to go hiking up there. Nobody ever gets permission. Hmm. And she got permission to go up there. I don't know, she was probably like 13, 14. She organized a group. Not gonna die.
He had a lot of struggles in this community.
Mm. I mean, she'd take a lot of people on.
She stood up to a lot of people, and you know, if she saw something that she didn't think was right, she'd say something. And here, that's not what really the school system, that they don't like that one bit. And so they, like, when she'd go to Guatemala or these places and witness these historic events, they'd go around and make sure that she didn't get her to take any tests or homework, so she got all F's on everything when she'd go do that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the administration made sure.
But she still ended up with pretty good grades.
Not that good.
You seem to have been so very supportive of Marla in her young days, letting her go to Central America and all those sorts of things. What was that like for you? Since your political views are so different.
Well, I think, you know, Nancy was a worldwide traveler, and I think, you know, that we wanted our children to have those opportunities. We just thought that those were, extraordinary opportunities for them, and we were glad they possessed those interests.
Mark went to Cuba at young age, on a global exchange trip. Perhaps you want to talk about that, Mark?
Yeah, I agree with what God said. You know, we're never told, like, don't do that or do this, or pushed into anything. And I don't know, we just kind of did. I don't know, we'd go to San Francisco and at 12 years old, I knew San Francisco, like, real well. and could
so
get
let
on,
me just
on an
interrupt.
Airplane.
Would you drive
yes.
your kids down there? Okay.
Yeah,
yes.
My mom would. We mainly go with trips with my mom and a friend. You know, or my sister would bring a friend, or I'd bring a friend, or we probably most of the time we were all friends. You know, and I don't know. And then like we go like my grandparents. My mom would. Was one time in down south in Southern California, and then my grandparents dropped us at the airport in Oakland, and we just got right, knew it exactly what to do, you know, and we were young, and they freaked out, you know, and well, we didn't. And,
the ticket counter did.
Yeah. We wouldn't freak out or nothing, and like we'd go with my godmom, and like Marla would always go talk to the homeless people. And my godmom would be like freaking out and just be like, it's no big deal, you know, she's just cheering them up. And I don't know, she just would feel sad, I guess. And then I would just be right there, right along with her. I'd be tagging along with her, she'd be tagging along with me. And it was good though. It was like really, I feel really lucky the way that we were raised. Just even though my parents have their strong political views, and we all have our strong views, but we were never told that they were wrong or that we should do this. Well, of course, there's the main things. Go to college, do your homework.
It was, wash your teeth, make
yeah,
your bed.
Yeah, whatever, you know. We definitely, we made a lot of our own decisions at a young age, you know. It started and we were pretty able to travel and survive. She told me a lot of things that I already understood, but just from kind of dealing, kind of partially understanding, you know, and traveling and being aware of some things, but she brought it. Boom. Oh, yeah, an epiphany type thing, like, oh, yeah, that makes sense, you know.
I remember taking him to San Francisco, and Marla would save her money to give to beggars on the street. And we said, Marla, so many of these people have drug and alcohol problems. It would be better if you gave them something to eat if they're claiming they're hungry. So I remember one particular day, Marla decided that she would go to Burger King and get a Whopper with fries for this one beggar in front of I-Magnets that we always saw in the same place. And he had a dog with him. And so Marla handed him the Whopper and the fries instead of money, and then she went around the corner, and she was peeking back around the corner when all of a sudden she saw him give the Whopper and the French fries to his dog. Obviously, he wasn't very hungry.
So she didn't, when she came here, she would, I don't know, she'd come and she'd like go jump and she'd swim out in the lake, those buoys. And then
quite a ways.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then she'd kinda come in and, or she'd rollerblade around a little bit, and then she'd be like in a book, and she'd have stacks of books and sat in her laptop. You know, and it'd be a hot summer day out, and she'd be, you know, just wrapped up in her work. And I don't know if that was also because, like, her demons that she had, like, you know, most of us have had, trying to hide those and involve herself up in something, you know, to get her mind off things.
I'm very curious what you think that brought to her social activism, her religious upbringing.
I think during the Mass, the sign of peace, where you offer the people around you peace and give them a hug, I think Marla carried that with her around the world and gave a lot of people hugs, told them she loved them, how beautiful they were and how wonderful they were. I think that part of the Mass had a great deal of influence on Marla. Like most of us, there was a period in her life where she wasn't very religious or claimed not to be. And then that changed. I had a conversation after the Washington, D.C. memorial with a nun that was well acquainted with Marla. He shared with me how spiritual Marla really was when she lived in Washington. And she did a lot of praying for victims and people that she sought for faith to get her through some of the difficulties she was facing in seeing these poor people who were having a very difficult time, especially in Afghanistan.
I think we would all trade everything Marla did. That might sound greedy, but to have her back with us, you know.
And the favorite story of the CCD teacher was that the CCD classes were held at an old house across from this church, you know, a two-story house where the nuns would stay in the summer that the church owned, with the casement windows that go up and down. And she left this large room with the class sitting around the table. And when she came back, the whole class had disappeared. And she goes, wait a minute, I had the only doorway guarded. They pushed up the casement windows, jumped out the windows, and were hiding on the other side. I can imagine who might have led that. So well, the teacher came back and there was absolutely no one there.
That was me who led it, and Marla would follow me, like I said, and I'd follow her. As if I wasn't tagging along with her, she was tagging behind me. So,
child during the you know, the whole Cold World scare and in the whole Cold War or whatever, and when the horrendous things of the 80s were going on, you know, like I said, when I was comparing myself to a girl my age in Guatemala, she was fleeing to Guatemala, I was playing soccer. So, you know, I was growing up in my beautiful childhood in this, you know, beautiful community. And, you know, if you just look at the lake long enough in the mountain, you can think, wow, there's no problems in this world just because it's so beautiful here. And my, you know, connection to what I thought was going on in the world at that time, I, you know, been drastically affected by, you know, I was getting things in the mail because I was doing research. I wanted, when I read the first testimony of a woman who was raped and children were killed, I was like calling every Guatemala Solidarity Group grassroots organization and saying, you know, send me literature now. And I was, you know, staying home from school and reading, or before I was doing anything, I was reading. And I just couldn't believe that my whole life I was to think that these things weren't going on, and they really were going on. So I was just going through this like personal change of the just the shock of first, I believe, you know, when you find out, like, without directly ever experiencing concrete injustice, growing up in a strong middle class family, not being a person of color, my life is pretty simple, and I've never directly experienced oppression or anything on me. So, and the point that I'm struggling to make is I was going through this kind of hurt time of, oh my God, people have to go through that. There's things like realizing, wow, you know, this country still has so much racism, and look at the backlash towards immigrants, and just, and seeing that it was still going on, I was really, like, hurt. Like, my heart was really, really, really broken, and so I was going through this kind of change where I didn't want to hang out, or I thought, like, why am I playing basketball? That seems so stupid, you know, and there's these horrible problems. So I was going through my hurt time, and then after I went, I saw, like, wow, me as an American citizen, I can use my middle-class background to get an education, to further my activism, and we organized an environmental club, and I was the president, so I said, well, let's send a caravan, you know, help send money for a caravan to Guatemala, and we did, and I just started realizing, hey, let's start doing things, and I can do things, I can get involved with grassroots groups and really make change, and I'm going to study this, and now the hurt thing, it just, of course, because I'm a human being with a heart, I still feel sadness to all the world's problems, but now it's like the activist rush of, you know, always got to be doing something and making a change as possible. And, I mean, I'm 20 years old. I pretty much know what I want out of life. I have a lot of friends who are like, well, what do I want to study? What do I want to do? And I'm straight on the ball with my activism. So I feel pretty secure now. And yep. I credit that to activism. peace and love is beautiful, but there can't be peace in this world when, you know, billions of people live in complete poverty and every 3 seconds a child is dying. Terrible diseases are hunger. So, you know, Guatemala is a good example, as is all of Central America and probably every third world country, in the ghettos in the United States where there's poverty, there's no education, there's no health. How can there be tranquility and how can people feel safe? I went to Cuba to study programs with children and to see how the effects of having things like daycare and good schools, how that helps women advance in society and so forth. And from being in Nicaragua and, you know, Guatemala and Salvador and other places where, you know, children don't have have very little schools or very little resources. And then going to Cuba, an island in the Caribbean, with 11 million people, after, you know, the revolution, they invested heavily in education and, you know, like the next generation, children and youth, educating them, giving them the sense that you are the most important thing. Now the most valuable resource Cuba has, you know, more so than sugar, is the minds of the people. Cuba, I didn't, you know, there weren't street children. There weren't children like in Guatemala sniffing glue to forget that they're hungry, like they do in every third world country where there's street children. In Cuba, where children's teeth are, their smiles are beautiful, they have dental care. That was like a big thing. Like, look at the children's teeth. Why don't they look gaunt? Children actually looked their age in Cuba. You know, in Honduras and Salvador, I met children that were like, well, not, they, I think they're children, but they were teenagers, 17 years old, who looked about 11. You could just see the hunger in that. And I think you can look a lot at a country and say a lot about a country's developments by looking at the children. There's programs for children, how children are treated. Cuba has put its resources for the children. In 94 was the first time I went to Cuba, and it was just this drastic period. But still, I was completely like, whoa, free healthcare, free, you know, education. And with the crisis that the country was in, they were saying, you know, the children were saying, no matter how bad it gets, we'll always have our love and our education and our school. My program, basically, it's interdisciplinary, and it enables me to be political, like to study politics and to study organizing and to basically get a degree in it, to do hands-on experience. It teaches us tools to be better activists. And, I mean, rarely in school settings, like I remember in college, do you learn about the struggles of the world. My education, because it's interdisciplinary and I'm allowed to take control of it, I learn how to organize, how people are organizing, what you can do to make the world, quote-unquote, a better place, through internships and through just directly being somewhere. It's enabled me to study in Cuba and to study throughout Central America, mm-hmm. and it gives me credit for internships. The thing that I see, all this poverty and these places like Nicaragua, is like that the best hopes for the people is like the grassroots projects that they've organized, like communities coming together and you know, making programs and sharing cooperatives and so forth, and like watching things get a little bit better. Yeah. And so, you know, I have to come home and I have to make sure that, you know, the Department of USAID, you know, I have to keep watching, study, you know, if I go to the internet and see like the urgent action alerts, like on somewhere like Nicaragua, and say like, well, what's the United States policy now to it? And I got to call Riggs and I got to call the White House and just make sure that now U.S. policy is, I'm kind of jumping into a lot of things, but just keeping my eyes open and doing what I can here. I went to Cuba to study programs with children and to see how the effects of having things like daycare and good schools, how that helps women advance in society and so forth. And from being in Nicaragua and, you know, Guatemala and Salvador and other places where, you know, children don't have very little schools or very little resources. And these countries have lush forests and various types of natural resources and so forth. And you can clearly see when, you know, children are dying of hunger that these resources are not being distributed. And then going to Cuba, an island in the Caribbean, with 11 million people, after the revolution, they invested heavily in education and the next generation, children and youth, educating them, giving them the sense that you are the most important thing. And now the most valuable resource Cuba has, you know, more so than sugar, is the minds of the people. Cuba, there weren't street children. There weren't children like in Guatemala sniffing glue to forget that they're hungry, like they do in, you know, every third world country where they're street children. In Cuba, where children's teeth are like, their smiles are beautiful. They have dental care. That was like a big thing. Like, look at the children's teeth. Look at their, why aren't their bellies distilled? Why don't they look gaunt? Children actually look to their age in Cuba. You know, in Honduras and Salvador, I met children that were like, I think they're children, but they were teenagers, 17 years old, who looked about 11. You could just see the hunger in that. And I think you can look a lot at a country and say a lot about a country's developments by looking at the children. And just how there's programs for children, how children are treated. And Cuba has put its resources for the children. But as you were talking about, with the blockade, the United States has maintained, so 93, 94, there was hardly, you know, they were saying no hay comida, there was no food, there was no cars because no gasoline, right. There was nothing. And 94 was the first time I went to Cuba, and it was just this drastic period, but still I was completely like, whoa, free healthcare, free, you know, education, and with the crisis that the country was in, they were saying, you know, the children were saying, no matter how bad it gets, we'll always have our love and our education and our school. Then after going back and seeing how the country's taking, you know, they're developing tourism, so things are improving greatly, but the United States still maintains the siege, this hostility, that depriving people of food and medicine. It's so hypocritical that we're trying to promote democracy while people with asthma are dying because they can't get their inhalers. There's literally slave labor. You know, they're making 101 Dalmatian pajamas in Burma for 6 cents an hour, Disney, an American corporation.
Right.
We traded with Guatemala. During the 80s when, you know, over 140,000 people were killed. We look at South Africa when there was apartheid. And it's continually hypocritical. Right. The best move for Cuba to improve its human rights standards is to, like, lift this blockade.
Right.
Cuba has, and I definitely think there needs to be moves for, you know, more democracy and so forth in Cuba, but Cuba is 90 miles away from the greatest power in the world, the United States, and that's also Cuba's greatest enemy. You know, we're taught that Cuba is the enemy and da da da.
Right.
And so they've lived in this, like, hostility since they came out of the revolution. There's a lot of things that are controlled, and that has a lot to do with the hostility from the United States.
Freshman year of college, the Friends World Program of Long Island University has students in the classroom the first semester. The second semester, they're encouraged to do a domestic internship. And Marla chose to go to D.C., where she worked with 50 years is enough. Then she, you know, went to other campuses, Africa, Jerusalem, Costa Rica. And when she graduated, she went to work for the Rainforest Action Network, and then she went to work on Medea Benjamin's campaign on the Green Party Senate race against Dianne Feinstein. Continued to work with Medea, then at Global Exchange, and went to Afghanistan to set up some reality tours that Global Exchange is very famous for, that Marla went on when she was in high school. So she went to Afghanistan, and then when the room was ready to come home, Marla apparently said, "I'm not going. I'm staying. I'm going to help these people." And that's when she proceeded to start the survey, because there were press reports that 4,000 or 5,000 people were dead. This wasn't true. That was exaggerated. So they were actually doing door-to-door surveys and checking hospital records and morgues. And so they actually came up with a pretty good survey of the number of people that were injured. And in doing this, she came up with claims of people that should be have some compensation. And the military really didn't want this broadcast because, my word, we have never aided war victims before. And so she carried the survey on into Iraq, but in the meantime she came back to the States and started lobbying in D.C. for help, met some very influential people who helped her mold her into the way she would present herself, and she'd made friends in the press in Afghanistan and also among NGOs, non-government organizations, friends with the U.N.
And how she made this transformation, I think, you know, Marla traveled a lot, you know, since she was small, and she traveled to places where there were unstable governments and there was horrendous poverty, you know, and then when she went to Long Island University, you know, she studied at all these various campuses, and, you know, she just had a lot of, she just had a lot of exposure to that, made some, you know, made some rational judgments and calls, and, you know, and I think took all of her experiences that she'd had, and, you know, she just sort of, you know, it's a sort of an evolving kind of process that she arrived at those kinds of decisions to do what she was doing, and yeah, she had no bones to pick, and that was good. You know, she didn't. And that, you know, why she was so effective was the fact that, you know, she could be relatively non-political and get along both with the military and the government and the people, and people truly believed that. I mean, she could go to, and it didn't matter where she went to, you know, she was openly accepted because she was so, a lot of people called her genuinely naive, but I think, you know, she was genuinely sincere, and people could read that in her, and she just had the ability to, you know, have people recognize that in her, and so she was, you know, she was able to do more.
She wasn't naive, that was one thing, she knew damn well what she was doing.
They thought she was naive, and they would tell her, "Hey, you can't do this."
In school, that's what they always did to her. They tell you, "You can't do that," and so you just tell her that you can't do that and just make her want to do it more, you know, how that goes.
She'd find a way to get it done.
Our family's kind of different, too. My mom's kind of pro-military, and Marla was socialist. I don't know if she still was socialist, but she had a lot of socialist views, definitely. She looked at Republicans and Democrats as almost as the same, pretty much. I mean, she got this book from my dad for Father's Day. It says, "You know you're a Republican when," and it was kind of a joke book, and "You know you're a Democrat when," you know, and it bashed both sides. She looked at them as the same. She didn't agree with either of them. But I'm just so proud of Marla. Marla didn't look at anybody's death as more important than the next person's death, no matter who they were. She did try to do so much, and the best thing she was with her heart, you know, and like my dad was saying, how sincere she was. And everyone knew that when she was speaking, from her heart. And I think that was her most effective, I think that was her biggest attribute, was her heart. And she was driven by her heart.
But one thing we can say about Marla, I think, you know, she inspired many people to do better and do more. I'm sure that's her legacy, and well, certainly has had an influence on, I think, on everyone that she knew. I think she has had some influence will be a better person. They will be more considerate of injustice and wrongdoings and those kinds of things. I mean, that's how I will remember Marla anyway.
She took the anger at injustice, and as you said, Mark, she was able to see into the individual people who maybe before she would have only seen them as getting in the way. Do you have any insights into how she made that transition?
Well, I remember one day her father said to her, "Marla, what are you getting accomplished with demonstrations?" how is this, what are you doing to see this through? It's nice to be out demonstrating, but clients and friends have said to us, what is your friend Medea getting accomplished? And I could see her mind clicking away. And after that, I started noticing a change in her. And now I'm reading through the first draft of the book that will probably come out in early 2007 about some of her transformation. And I think there were a lot of people who influenced her transformation, including her friend Tim Reeser, who's an aide to Senator Leahy, U.S. Air Force adjutant general, and he would jog with her. And then Bobby Mueller of
that was
Vietnam,
in this country?
Yes.
No,
in Iraq. He would jog with her as Jag Tracy. They're called Jags in the Air Force. And then Bobby Mueller of the Vietnam Veterans America, who was shot in Vietnam and disabled, and he navigates very well with a wheelchair. Also, I think had a great deal of influence with her, and she decided to start her organization, Civic.
She branched, got away from India and just saw that there was other people that were activists and successful activists that had different philosophies on how to do things that she met, and she kind of took all that. And she was open-minded enough to, I'd tell her all the time, we'd fight all the time about it. Like, you're not getting nothing accomplished, but she wouldn't listen to me, because she listened to me up until she was about 17, and everything I said, she did,
Those were the days.
Yeah. But Dad, she listened to Dad, but maybe it was the way Dad said it to her is better saying that to her, too, because I would be real straightforward with her. And she didn't like that too much. And I had a lot of problems with global exchange for a long time. But, if it wasn't for, global exchange helped Marla out a whole lot. But I don't know. I think the media had a big influence on her, too, just becoming friends with the media and being around those people. And I don't know. I think they had a big influence on her, though, too. She had a lot of... Most of her friends were... I don't know. I think Marta was too very genuine, but also, like, that JAG officer... one of her translators was a girl, she told me. And she thought that, Marla was like a slut because she'd go running around with this JAG officer. And Marla's like, what are you doing with the guy? Then Marla all the time, and she's like, I'm getting information from him. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if it was... I'm sure it came into it. All this stuff came to friendships because Marla was... if you were nice to Marla, Marla's nice to you, and do on to others as you want them to do on to you, But I think all of it, all these friendships came about as to help her be able to help her cause. So that's how I think a lot of those relationships came about,
And the media told her story and got the word out. That's why she wanted to be in good graces with the media. Well, tremendous assistance to her.
They were the only people that were around, too. There was no organizations in Iraq.
They left.
And Jill Carroll, that was hard, too. Jill Carroll getting kidnapped because that brought it up a lot. Marla and her were friends, so that was hard.
Marla encouraged Jill Carroll to stay in Iraq and stick it out.
Oh, boy.
What I've tried to do is, like I think Marla did... was put herself in their shoes, put themselves not in the victim's shoes, but also in these military people's shoes, politicians' shoes.
She had spent time in college in Jerusalem, and she taught in a preschool in Palestine, and she... I expected her to be very pro-Israeli, and said she ended up being pro-Palestinian. When Marla finished college, before she went to Afghanistan, I thought sure she'd be going back to Ramallah. Instead, she went to Afghanistan. I was quite relieved, frankly, because look what has happened there, and I was fearful for her life there, more so than her going to Afghanistan. During Vietnam, I was a flight attendant for a charter air carrier, and we had contracts to take troops all over the world. When Cliff referred to my having traveled all over the world, that's how I traveled, as transporting military personnel, their families, and charter flights throughout the world. And so here I was going into Vietnam a couple of times a week. You know, the captain of the aircraft would say, okay, you girls all strapped down back there, and we'd go diving into Saigon or Ben Hoa or Cameron Bay. And a friend of mine later said, when I was complaining to her that Marla was in Afghanistan and then later Iraq, she said, how do you think our mothers felt when we were going into Saigon twice a week during the height of the war? And I'd say, well, you know, you're right. I would keep Baghdad time when Marla was in Baghdad, so I didn't wake her up. It was 11 hours difference.
Because I wanted to go with her to Iraq to be her bodyguard, you know, and she's like, no, because I'll just give me an AK over there and I'll walk around, I'll be your bodyguard. She's like, no, because that brings attention to you. Well, yeah, it does, you know, and I need to know that, you know, just kind of stuff like that. Like, it just really amazed me how she changed in a couple years. I don't know what it was. What do you need?
Mustard.
Mustard.
You can call this lunch for the Ruzicas.
Well, yes, Marla started out as a protester and taking on several issues, but what she was seeing was, you know, you brought the issue to focus, but then, you know, you dropped it at that particular point. You went on to the next issue, and, you know, nothing positive seemed to come about bringing all of that to her attention. So I think that's when she kind of matured and decided that, yes, we have all these injustices. We need to bring them to people's attention, and then we need to do something about them. There's a lot of groups in the United States around the world that protest. There's not a lot of them that roll up their sleeves and go do something about them. And, you know, that's what I think that's what distinguished Marla from a lot of other people. Not that a lot of other people do is very, very good work, too, but just Marla just took it a step further.
And also, you know, just by being able to work with those people that she had to work with, to be able to keep calm and work with them, you know.
You know, as time goes on, though, you know, and as you know, acceptance becomes somewhat easier. Time heals slowly. We are, or I am, proud of the fact that she did do some very good humanitarian work and doing what good people do, you know. I mean, extraordinarily good people do, you know, Marla, you know. And, you know, and so I'm proud of her that she lost her life doing something, you know, worthwhile. You know, that gives me solace and support.
Our local Catholic priest, Father Ted Osborne, attended the seminary in Rome. And he had a lot of classmates that were calling him after Marla's death, as they realized in the press he was our local parish priest. And one of them called and said, we need to nominate her for sainthood. And he just burst out laughing because he remembers Marla at church camp in the summertime up on Cobb Mountain. He said, Saint Marla, no, she wasn't a saint. So Marla was a typical kid. Even at church camp.
Yeah, but Marla was doing God's work, and she had trouble with God with all the things she had seen and worked and dealing with seeing the work and all the deaths, you know, and being in Jerusalem or in Palestine, you know, and seeing that, and then also going to these other places around the world and seeing all this religion, and then going to Cuba, basically where there is no religion and less conflict. Because Marla just wanted everyone to be happy, you know, because that's what made her happy. You know, to me, she was doing God's work, and she did accept God before she died.
And that makes me, gives me solace too, that she did accept God. Because when she was having problems and nowhere to turn, she kept counting on human beings, and that wasn't working out for her, which is how her solve her problems. You know, she realized that she didn't need, she started asking me about, like, for spiritual advice, because she saw me and my struggles and what helped me. You know, that gives me, makes me feel really good that she did accept God, because that, but that's what she was doing, was God's work. We need more people like Marla, obviously, but obviously that's rare. What we need more of is just, what I think if Marla would say too, is that, you know, just this grassroots thing, you know, if it's, if we all just did just a tiny, itty-bitty little bit, it can make a difference. You know, you don't have to dedicate your life to it like she did. I think we would all trade everything Marla did. That may sound greedy, but to have her back with us, you know, and that's what's kind of hard on me, at least.
The anniversary of her death this year will be Easter Sunday. And Easter Sunday traditionally is the probably unofficial start of spring. I think she was a beautiful flower in our lives and the lives of so many in the world. I can encourage young people to go out in the world and try to make it a better place for everyone. Young people here have so much, and that's not true in other parts of the world. I think they can make a difference. You get what you give. So I encourage them to be giving, and their parents to give them some leeway to be independent. Not only independent thinkers, but teach them to be self-sufficient, to learn their way around the world. If you take them to a resort in Mexico, make sure they see the poverty side of Mexico, the children selling chiclets. The children should learn to share, and I would tell Marla that children were selling chiclets to help their family survive, so to help the mother feed the family.
Well, to the young people of the world, in the spirit of Marla, I would encourage them to follow their heart, be brave, be objective and considerate of all points of view, and to particularly be kind and loving and make a more peaceful world. Be inspired by what Marla did, and in your own way, do whatever you can to promote peace and promote a better world and promote food for all of the people of the world and promote peace. And but you'll have to fight. You may have to fight in order to obtain peace, so it's not a free ride. There are prices to be paid.
2 days before she died, Marla sent an email. It said, "Hello, just a quick note to say that Foz, who runs Civic in Iraq, and I are safe. Today there were some car bombs that exploded close to where I stay, but we are very much protected in the compound where I live. At the time, I was in the green zone meeting with a senior official from the Ministry of Human Rights. I will leave early next week. It will be hard because we are doing tremendous work and solving many problems. I am very safe. However, I know when you hear news of kidnappings and bombs, it does not put your mind at ease. So I want to assure you that I am fine and exercising good judgment, to borrow a quote from my dad." Lots of love, Marla.
There were many testimonials and tributes as word spread of Marla's death in Baghdad on April 16, 2005. We end with the words of Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy, with whom she worked to secure funds for innocent civilian victims of the U.S. war in Iraq, speaking on the floor of the U.S. Congress.
Marla was the founder of a humanitarian organization called Campaign for Innocent Victims in Conflict. That's devoted to helping the families of Afghan and Iraqi citizens who have been killed or suffered. Either their homes have been destroyed or businesses destroyed as a result of U.S. military operations. We know that such suffering occurs no matter how careful military may be. But Saturday, Marla died in Baghdad. She died from a car bomb. Car bomb not directed at her, but directed at a convoy. She was doing the work she loved and which so many people around the world admired her for. She was on her way just to help somebody else. As a case of being in the wrong place, the wrong time. But not unusual because she had risked her life so many times in Afghanistan, Iraq. I met her 3 years ago when she first came to Washington. She's barely 26 years old. She'd been in Afghanistan. She'd seen the effects of U.S. bombing mistakes that destroyed the homes and lives of innocent Afghan citizens. In one or two incidents, wedding parties had been bombed. In others, the bombs had missed their targets, instead destroyed homes and neighborhoods. I remember where one incident she spoke of where every member of a family of 16 people was killed, except a young child, that child's grandfather. These were the cases Marla spoke about. She spoke about them passionately because she felt passionately that the United States should help those families put their lives back together. She met with me. She met with Tim Reeser in my office, who works on appropriations for me in the Foreign Operations Subcommittee. It didn't take her long to convince either Tim or myself that she was so obviously right. We knew that we not only had a moral responsibility to those people who had suffered because of the United States' mistakes, we also had an interest in mitigating the hatred and the resentment towards Americans that those incidents had caused. And it was Marla's initiative, going to Afghanistan, meeting those families, getting the media's attention, coming back here, meeting with me and with Tim and others, that led to the creation of a program that has contributed more than $8 million for medical assistance or to rebuild homes, to provide loans, to start businesses, for other aid to innocent Afghan victims of the military operations. And from Afghanistan, Marla went to Iraq. She arrived, so I recall, a day or two after Saddam's statue fell. She and an Iraqi colleague, Fayez Ali Salam, who died at the same time, in the same place as Marla, organized dozens of Iraqi volunteers to conduct surveys around the country of civilian casualties. And then she returned to Washington. And again, her efforts, and I have to emphasize her efforts, her personal efforts, her pounding on doors, her going person to person with her irrepressible energy led to the creation of a program now known as the Civilian Assistance Program, and has provided $10 million to the families and communities of Iraqi citizens killed by U.S. and other coalition forces. Another $10 million was allocated for this program just last week. You know, to my knowledge, this is the first time we've ever provided this type of assistance to civilian victims of U.S. military operations. It would never have happened without the initiative, the courage, the incomparable force of character of Marla Ruzicka. In my 31 years as a United States Senator, I've met a lot of interesting, accomplished people from all over the world. All of us do. I've never met anyone like Marla. She made sure we knew what she was doing and how we could help. One story I remember the day after Marla arrived in Washington, Kabul. She had heard there was a hearing in the Senate where Secretary Rumsfeld and General Franks were going to testify. Now, thinking perhaps a bit naively that they might talk about the problem of civilian casualties, she decided to go to hear what they'd say. After the hearing was over, obviously disappointed that the issue she cared so deeply about hadn't even been mentioned, Marla walked straight up to Secretary Rumsfeld at the witness table, started talking to him. He heads down the hallway. She heads down the hallway with him. I can imagine what the security people felt. Followed him right outside to his car. And she did not stop talking to him about the families of civilians she had met who had been killed or injured and the need to do something to help them. Now, anybody who knew Marla can see that. Secretary of Defense, heck, Secretary of State, United States Senator, doesn't make any difference. She has a story to tell. And by golly, you're going to hear that story. You're going to hear that story. You can run down the hall. You can go up the elevator. You can go out to the car. You're going to hear the story. She was not someone who was easy to say no to. Not easy. Heck. It was almost impossible to say no to her. And that was not simply because she was insistent. We all have insistent people who come to our offices. And we've all developed ways to say no. But in her case, she was not just insistent, she was credible. She had been there. She knew what the war was about. She'd seen the tragic results. And she was not about blaming anyone. She wasn't there to protest others, to blame others. She just said, look, there are people that need help. I want to help, whatever way I can. That's what made it different. She saw her work as part of the best of what this country is about. It was the face of a compassionate America that she believed in. She wanted the people of Afghanistan and Iraq to see the face of America she believed in, this compassionate, humanitarian face. It took time for some of us to realize she wasn't just a blonde bundle of energy and charisma, which she was, but she was also a person of great intellect and courage who realized that if she wanted to help war victims, it wasn't enough to protest. That you can do easily. She needed to work with people who could help her do it. And, of course, that meant the Congress, the U.S. military, the U.S. embassy, the press, and everybody else involved. She understood that. So she put aside politics and focused on the victims. But she made sure the Congress, the U.S. military, the U.S. embassy, the press, and everybody else heard from her. But it didn't take long before the U.S. military saw the importance of what she was doing, and they started to help her. There were several civil affairs officers with whom Marla worked like a team. She'd find the cases. They had arranged for the plane to airlift a wounded child to a hospital or some other type of assistance. She became one of our most beloved ambassadors because she was doing what our ambassadors want to do, put the good face, the humanitarian face, the loving and caring face of America first and foremost. And I think one of the reasons so many people around the world feel Marla's loss so deeply is because we saw how important her work was, and that meant taking risks the rest of us are unwilling to take. In a way, she was not only helping the families of Iraqi war victims, she was also helping us until she finally became an innocent victim of war herself.
Here is a short collage of Marla in her own voice while in Afghanistan and Iraq.
You told your mother that you were going to London?
Yeah, on the phone when I was in San Francisco. And then the day before I said Pakistan. Just because I had a lot of preparing to do before I left and I didn't want lots of frantic phone calls.
Sir!
Civilians always get harmed. All over the world, there's always more civilians than soldiers. In war, innocent civilians should not be hurt. It happens. Now, we have to see what you do to help the families that were hurt.
Nobody's keeping track of the casualties, so we have no idea how many Iraqis have been killed at checkpoints, have been killed after the U.S. response to a suicide bombing. Nobody's keeping those statistics.
Each number represents a need, represents a father, a mother, a loss of life.
We're going to be submitting about 450 family claims.
1 year. People cannot wait a year for the help they need.
When you're the most powerful country in the world, when you spend $30 million a day on the bombing campaign, you can spend $20 million. That's what we're asking, $10,000 per family.
We're working on some cases so that we can have a tangible example to show the U.S. how they can help people. If we as a small advocacy group can do it on the resources that are in this country, then we want to show the United States government what they can do.
According to the emergency responders, Marla's last words were, "I'm alive." Her spirit and her work does live on and inspires all who learn of her life and dedication. Marla liked to tell people, "To have a job where you can make things better for people, that's a blessing. Why would I do anything else?" And that's exactly what she was doing when that roadside explosion cut short her life. Her friend and mentor, Medea Benjamin, put it well when she said, One of the things we can do to honor Marla Ruzicka is to carry on her heartfelt work to build a world without hunger, war, and needless suffering. Every time we get depressed about the state of the world, we should take inspiration from Marla's boundless energy and throw ourselves back into the work of global justice with the same kind of passion that was Marla's most endearing quality. The organization Marla founded, CIVIC, which stands for the Campaign for the Innocent Victims in Conflict, seeks to mitigate the impact of war and its aftermath by ensuring that timely and effective assistance is provided to victims of conflicts. CIVIC also works to promote public understanding, engagement, and support for the human dimension of war. They continue to monitor the distribution of the Marla Ruzicka Iraqi War Victim Fund, as well as the ongoing situation there. You can find out more about CIVIC by going to www.civicworldwide.org. Remembering Marla has been a Beyond the Deep End presentation. Engineer Al Rosen, General Factotum Ivar Traber. Thanks to Mary Eigner, Burton Siegel, and Annie Esposito. Thanks also to Andy Weiss and Robert Lozano, KPFZ, Lakeport, California, whose foresight in recording Marla Ruzicka at age 20 allowed us to share her voice with you. We express our sincere sympathy and appreciation to the Ruzicka family, her parents, Nancy and Cliff Ruzicka, and her twin brother, Mark, for sharing their memories and insights of Marla with us on March 19th, 2006. I'm Joy LeClaire.
We've only got these times we're living in. We've only got these times we're living in. Thank you.